Chaps. How are you, John?
Great, I'm great. It's good to see you, Scott.
Good to see you too, mate. It's been a while. We had some fun back in 2011, Baton Rouge.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, I think it was up till that point, the kind of defining thing that I've been a part of and something where I think I learned the most and was able to kind of express myself the most and sort of has informed everything since. I think anything good that's happened to me since has been a result of that movie, really, because it's developed its kind of underground, you know, cult fan base, I would say, a lot of them being filmmakers and people in the film community. So anyone who's hired me since then or financed things I'm doing, it's all had to do with that movie.
Yeah, brilliant movie. Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning is what we're talking about. And, you know, my show is all about shooting action and how to make action movies. And that is a fine action movie. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of great action directors like Isaac Florentine and Chad Stahelski and Sammo Hung and Jackie Chan. And all these guys, they come from a martial arts background and, you know, they come up through the stunt world and things like that. They learn about action from the inside out. But it always intrigues me when I meet a director like yourself or somebody like Gareth Evans, who just understands action so brilliantly the way that you do, but it hasn't come from being a stuntman or a martial artist or a place like that. I guess it's just coming from, obviously your father is a famous director, which would help, who'd done Absolutely. Some action films, but also just to understand it at the level that you understand it and not coming from martial arts or stunt background.
Well, first and foremost, you mentioned my father. I learned everything from him. I really have. I grew up on his sets and I grew up watching his movies and I grew up talking about movies with him and learning how to break them down. He taught me the craft of filmmaking and it was from watching how he constructed a scene and what the point of view of the scene was and how to look at action that way. And so, you know, and something he is great at and what I learned so much was about creating visceral action, putting you in the action. And there's a many different ways to do it. I don't even think stylistically my dad and I are the same. We have our own approach, but I saw how he approached action and how the action in his films, it was always very propulsive and there was an audio element that was really powerful. And so it was very, you know, it was a very kind of immersive experience that he seemed to be going for that. So I think that was my first hook, but I think it's interesting how you say, yeah, people like Isaac Florentine or Jackie Chan, they're doing it from the inside out. And someone like me is doing it from the outside in, which is very true. And I think it probably goes back to the fact that I started out in documentary, you know, and in documentaries, what I learned was that what I could bring to the table as a documentary filmmaker and storyteller is that I'm the audience. So I didn't make documentaries about things I was an expert in. I would work with people who are experts in the subject. So for The Smashing Machine, let's say, which is something that I did, which was about the world of MMA, I didn't know anything about MMA when I made it. My producers knew a lot about MMA and were very deeply entrenched in the world. What I could then be is the eyes and ears of the audience. And I could look at this as an outsider who's trying to bring the audience into a world. So in creating fiction storytelling, and whether it's action or suspense or anything else, my job is really, I can sort of just bring the viewer in as someone and assume that the audience doesn't necessarily know about what we're talking about. Take that documentary experience. If I'm doing something about MMA, especially in 2000, you know, the early 2000s, which is when I did that, most people don't know what it is. So you can't just go into that and assume everyone knows what's going on and make it just an insider thing. You want to pull any viewer in. So that doesn't mean you have to explain everything. And quite the contrary, everything I do usually has very little explaining, but it's about visually explaining something. How do I tell the story visually in the case if it's a fight? How do I make the viewer, the audience, feel like they are, in some cases you could be seeing it from afar with long lenses and you're sort of, it's voyeuristic. The action that we did together, it always felt important to me that you're right over the shoulder of the people that are in this fight, that you're standing next to them in the room, very close to them, and that everything that's happening is very close to you. And so that informed a lot of the decisions that were made in terms of cutting or not cutting, really. You know, how long to hold a shot? How do you really put the audience in the geography? How do you make sure that the punches and kicks and whatever it is, the impact is really being felt by the audience? And the reality of filmmaking, and the better you get at it, the more you realize that so much of it is bringing your own aesthetic and surrounding yourself with experts. So in the case of Day of Reckoning, I had two incredible experts in you and Larnell Stovall. You know, so really, you and Larnell introduced me in a very deep way, in a deeper way than I had been introduced before, into that world of choreographing fights like that, and that art form of choreographing. I'd done fights before and worked with some good people, but Larnell was another level, and you're very savvy yourself about where the camera should be in terms of how to present a move or a moment and what's the best place to see that. So
you'd already done the first Universal Soldier Regeneration before that, and the fights in that are sick.
Yeah, and that was Bobby Iliev, you know, who, yeah. You know, Bobby deserves that credit. And so what I can bring to that table is, whether it's you and Larnell or someone like Bobby will show me something that's very, you know, that could be very intricate choreography. And what I'm always interested in, and I think I just keep moving closer and closer to that, and it probably is still rooted in the documentary stuff, is that I want it to feel real, you know? I want it to have impact. I want it to be messy. You know, we were working on a movie that, because you guys were not normal humans, let's say, it could allow for this very acrobatic, kind of spectacular, choreographed type of action. And it could still exist in the reality of our story, in our science fiction story. But even within that, I didn't necessarily want it to feel like kung fu cinema. You know, I wanted it, which is great, but that's almost like dance choreography. It's not really about the realism or impact of every blow, and it's more about impressive choreography. I wanted to merge the impressive choreography of Larnell and your talent as a performer and also just as an artist who understands action, and marry that with something that still was very visceral. So those the blows and everything had impact. It felt real.
So the first time I saw your work was Universal Soldier Regeneration. And that's what struck me when I watched it. I saw a stripped down, no bullshit version of, you know, Universal Soldier 1, which is a great film. But the direction you took it with number 3 was just to strip away all the bullshit. And it's almost, I felt like I was watching Black Hawk Down, and it was, you know, all these guys that were in Mogadishu, but instead of them being soldiers, it was these Unisols. And it was very realistic. And the action was extremely realistic, almost to the point of shocking. And, you know, some of the stuff in there would just make you go, Jesus Christ, did I just see what I think I saw? And the way he will just pound people's faces in a very realistic way. I mean, stuff like that, you know, that was, it felt new. It was something different.
Well, yeah, that, so that was based on probably my experience doing doing the Smashing Machine, the documentary, and seeing real fights up close by professionals who are really good at it, and thinking about what really happens in a fight when one person gets the best of the other. And, yeah, and it's something I hadn't really seen in a movie, which is it was ground and pound, and because the ground and pound is like it's not the most elegant of fight moves, but it's really brutal, you know. And it's one thing to have a referee stop it. It's another thing to watch someone, you know, if someone was trying to kill another person and they just were able to take them down and get in that position, just repeated blows to the head would probably be the move. And I think in a weird way, the idea is that I always want the violence, while certainly in these Unisol movies, they're meant to thrill the audience, you know, the audience is going along for it, but in the same way that, you know, the shark in Jaws thrills the audience, it should be, I kind of want it to make the fights and the violence a little scary, like something you don't want to be involved in, so that that's creating kind of that's creating tension for the audience. And I think by the time you and I were working together, and by the time we did Day of Reckoning, I felt like that case, it was almost like action as horror was the-
It absolutely was, yeah. A really great combination. But this fight here, I mean, obviously the stunt guy's done a brilliant job and they've choreographed it great. But, you know, you're holding the camera back. We can see everything that's going on. And when you've got two great performers like these two, Andre and Dion, you can. But, yes, it's that brutality.
That was, again, that's Andre and Dion. That's no stunt doubles at all.
But moments like this, John, where they just take a breath. I mean, those are little moments that, you know, that fit, we're not used to seeing, and really good stuff.
Yeah, that was, I forget who came up with that. You know, these fights here, this was really about Bobby and Andre and Dion and all those guys. At a certain point, we would all go to the gym. You know, I would watch them, and Bobby would work these things out. And, you know, he's a very clever guy, and he's got a lot of great – he's got a very cinematic eye, you know, yeah. I noticed early on. And he would pre-viz these things, and it was working those out. And I think, yeah, that little break that we thought of, the guys catching a breather, I think it was about when you're dealing with these – superhuman, almost Terminator-like characters, how do we make them flesh and blood so that they're not invulnerable, they have some vulnerability. That way we can, when they're fighting, and I think you and I were always talking about this, like, it's not that you don't feel pain, you just feel less than the average bloke, right? So it's, but if you're up against someone who is as powerful as you, then it's just like a regular fight between two people. It's just going to be more impressive to watch, but you guys are feeling pain. It's important that they're feeling pain so that there's some stakes involved.
Can you talk about the sound design then of a fight scene? Because you do something drastically different to a lot of directors, I think, especially for the film that we did. The sound design of that, there was, you know, it was almost weird. It was like a haunting noise in the back of the movie. It was almost like there was an alarm, but it wasn't. It was a soundtrack. Anyway, we'll get on to that. We'll talk about Day of Reckoning. But for this film as well, it's is there music in this?
To me, the audio of a movie is, I feel like the sound and the music all share the same space together. So I don't really think of them as separated elements. I think of them as all parts of a larger department, which is the audio department. And they're all functioning the same way. They're all, I really believe that they are impacting the audience even more than the visuals. You know, I believe it's probably 60-40 sound to picture. in terms of what's making you laugh, cry, scream, all those things, that the way film manipulates us and affects us emotionally. That's the audio. Now, audio can be words, you know, audio can be a conversation. Audio can be heavy string music. Audio could be silence and dripping water. It's all that audio space, but that's the heartbeat, right? That's the rhythm of the whole thing. That's the tempo of the whole thing. Yes, editing informs rhythm and tempo, but I really think audio informs it more than actually even the rhythm of picture edits. Mm. So in approaching it that way, again, this is something I learned from my dad early on. I remember I think he probably pointed this out to me, but the car chase in The French Connection has no music.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure the car chase in Bullet has no music. And those are always cited as two of the best ever.
Yeah.
So it's pretty clear that you don't need music necessarily to create something stirring and thrilling. And in many ways, sometimes music can detract. So if you're thinking those things as working together, I started following the thought process that if you're dealing with something that is very, very percussive and propulsive, just from an audio perspective, take any fight from Day of Reckoning, but even in Regeneration, we did one where they were crashing through walls and banging into pots and pans and all these kinds of things. So already you're dealing with a lot of sound that is filling the audio space, not to mention the impacts and the blows and body hits and the grunts. Mm. So imagine that's all filling the sound space. It's a finite amount of space. You can't just keep layering. You end up having, you only occupy a certain amount of space, and then you throw music in that. Well, something's got to give. And often I see a lot of movies where they'll have a big fight or a big car chase and then big bombastic music with big percussion. And all they're really doing then is turning the sound down and the music up, or turning the music down and the sound up, and they're just kind of mixing them globally.
Yeah.
To me, that's a lot of wasted effort, and I don't even think it's achieving what you need. So rather than having really percussive music and really percussive action and just turning the music down, so now the music's kind of not doing anything, well, let's just say that the sound itself is the percussion. And so the music, if you're going to have any, can then exist on a more ambient atmospheric plane. It could be melody if you want, but we tend to not go that way during the fight scenes, because sometimes when you remove the melody, when you remove the idea of this is where it's going, which is what music makes you feel sometimes. Music is leading you somewhere. Oh, something good's going to happen or something bad's going to happen. But when you take that out, it makes the audience very uncomfortable because they don't know where it's going to go. So they don't know, well, who's going to win this? It almost creates more suspense just by its absence, because now the audience is left with the discomfort of listening to these fights. I remember doing the Smashing Machine. We were shooting in Tokyo in these Pride fighting championships. And in Pride...
Yeah, I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, in Japan, they don't make a lot of noise. They make almost no noise during the fights themselves. So we would be ringside filming these fights, and you could hear the fighters' feet dragging across the canvas.
Now we all know what it sounds like because of COVID-19. However, back then...
Well, that's true. You watch like The Ultimate Fighter, that show, you get a sense of that. Because you'd be like the guys in the ring in the corner cheering, and you hear what a fight sounds like.
But it's brutal, isn't it? It's
brutal. Yeah. So that, to me, that was so tense to listen to a quiet, you know, to listen to a fight in silence. If you're like blasting music, it almost makes you feel more comfortable. So my goal was always to make it uncomfortable not to be unentertaining. I want to be entertaining, but because, you know, tension and fear is entertaining to me, because then you survive it. You know, then you come out, you raise your heart rate, and then you bring it down, and then you raise it back up. So how we can, so that is, so much of that audio is like playing with the heart rate of the audience. And in Day of Reckoning, we really had a lot of fun, because it's a very psychological story, and gets very surreal at times, because you're in the head of this character. We did stuff in that where with cicada sounds and you know, all kinds of sounds that would just be kind of things that the audience might feel and not hear. And we used an actual alarm, and then the score had a kind of alarm like sound, and we did a very long kind of crossfade between those two, so that the sound of the alarm became then a musical version of the alarm. We would do it with a fan. It would always pick something that was in the sound and then make that part of the music track, so you didn't even know it was music. Yeah. It was cool stuff.
Now, this end fight with Van Damme and Dolph in Regeneration.
Yeah.
What really impressed me about it, and I know that we did this in our movie as well, and what you love to do is a case of cause and effect. So you always like to put around a lot of stuff that we can smash through the walls and pots and pans and everything. Just talk us through that, John.
Yeah, the concept of this fight was the bulls in the china shop. You know, that was kind of what it started from. Watching two people have a fight in a big open warehouse can be a way to observe choreography. But in this case, we wanted just to, how do you show the power of these guys, especially if they're going against each other, then it's pretty much going to be a fairly even match. But if we put them against physical architecture, now we really see that these are like two gargantuans. So that was the main thing. Second thing is thinking about close quarters, right? Just having you bang into everything. Now you think of the audio and how that relates to that, and you think of how percussive the audio becomes. And then it started being, pots and pans, put them in a kitchen. So then we got a lot of, you know, metallic sounds. Now you have the sounds of crashing through windows, and now you have tiles. So it's all about how much the sound is playing into this is such a big part of it. Yeah. And then it was also to give it movement, right? So that instead of a fight in a room, it's a fight that's going to travel through a number of spaces. It's going to start in one place, and you're going to enter all these different rooms that each have, it's almost like a different chapter to the fight. And then by the end, you've gone outside, you've gone out the window, and there's the final chapter. So I think that's something that Larnell always talked about. And I always thought he, you know, had such a brilliant mind for, is the narrative of the fight, you know, that every fight has a story to it, and fights reveal character. You know, and now this ending, which was...
Can I just say that Dolph's had some great death scenes, but I think this is the best.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that the whole thing of this fight, too, was like, you know, because this movie was kind of getting into the existential angst of these clones, right? These humans who were not entirely human. So this was kind of a setup punchline, right? There's a big, slow, drawn-out monologue that starts this whole thing before they actually start fighting. So we build the tension before they clash, where Dolph has got these two kids in the corner and he's holding a knife. And he was really good. He delivered that so well. I mean, Dolph's a lot of fun to work with when it comes to delivering these certain pieces of dialogue. And
that's a good job.
Yeah, right. So I think that was a dummy that we put Dolph's face on.
Handsome dummy.
Yeah, I think it was a dummy for that shot.
Brilliant film. I loved it. I was actually up for one of the parts at one point. I don't even know if you know this, but I can't remember the reason why I didn't do it or why I didn't get it. but it was the Mike Pyle one.
Yeah, exactly. I remember you being up for, I don't remember why you didn't get that part, or why it didn't work out.
I think I might have wanted a bigger part.
Yeah, you probably did. Yeah, I think you didn't want to do it, but which is good. I'm glad you didn't, because
when I watched it, I was like, oh man, this is a really good movie. Yeah.
Right, but it laid the groundwork for Day of Reckoning, you know, and that was the interesting thing, is that our after doing Regeneration, now I was kind of working in your orbit, and all the people I worked with were people who work with you, and I think Franklin Vallette, our AD, was a guy who first told me about you. And show me videos, and you know, because that was the thing, is like it's one thing to work with incredible stunt people, but it's hard to find one who can also act and carry a movie. And
there's not many of us. Very difficult.
Right. And so that was always the story behind you. And it was about when it came time for Day of Reckoning, again, it just, what's the point of repeating yourself? There's really no point. So you have to come up with a whole new thing. And when it came time for Day of Reckoning, it was like, I'm excited to do another chapter in this story, but it can't just be the sequel to that movie. It has to be something different. We need someone new at the center of this who's going to be our protagonist. So that was one of the first things I asked for when it came time to trying to do that movie was, of course, we want Jean-Claude and Dolph in there, but I need this to be someone else's journey. Tell the story from the perspective of the Frankenstein monster and tell that story of him discovering that he is in fact a monster. He doesn't realize it. He starts out thinking he's a normal human.
That's what makes the film brilliant. I think it's also what leaves some people not really getting it as well. Because, you know, you're following the movie, my character, he's the hero. And then by the time you get to the end of the film, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, you know, within the last 10 years, it's too late. But, you know, by the time we get to the end, we realize that I'm the bad guy, right?
He's a super villain.
I'm the one who's working for the government that's been sent to take out Van Damme's character and all the rest of them. And that's a stroke of genius for me. But also, you're obviously a big horror fan, and mixing these elements of horror, it's almost more of a horror film than an action film.
Yeah, and most, you know, to me, every movie ultimately is, well, not every, but let's just say more often than not, I find that a movie has to be reverse engineered from what do you have? How much money do you have? What are the immovable pieces? Who is, you know, whether it's certain actors who are attached, certain storylines, certain universes that you're in. In the case of Day of Reckoning, we were given a certain amount of money and they'd sold it as we had to shoot it in 3D. And there's a lot of people get money off the top of that anyway. So like whatever our budget was, whether it was 8 or something million, once you get to your production budget, it's like 3 something million. So, okay. I'm not saying we can't make a cool movie with that. But what I am saying is you can't make, I remember at that time, I think like G.I. Joe was coming out. These kind of like PG action movies with big budgets.
Yeah.
And one of the big fights I had with the producer, Moshe Diamant, ultimately I was able to prevail, but it was a big fight during production, was making Regeneration, what would be the rating? And I said, this has to be an R movie. You know, we don't have enough money for it to be PG. You know, if you're going to do a PG movie, then you need scope. And even still, my interest in that is limited, but if that's the way we're going to go, then you need way more money. But if you only have a certain amount, then, and in the case of Day of Reckoning, we had so little money that I thought, well, we can't do more kind of spectacular scope than The Matrix or G.I. Joe for that matter, or whatever is out there, or Fast and Furious, take your pick.
Yeah.
But what we can do, if we can lean into hard R territory, is we can make our fights that are just happening in apartments and houses and things like that, in sporting goods stores, they can be really, they can have a lot of impact. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to...
And cater for the other audience.
Yes.
They may not be feeling like watching a PG-13 that night.
Well, that's right. And that we're just going to say, this is not a movie for them. This is a movie for, you know, for people like when I was a kid, I liked R-rated, you know, movies.
I'm right, man. Yeah.
And we're going to show, we're going to make this action, again, really brutal, really savage. I mean, it's funny to watch it now because it's like today I wouldn't even go as far as I did then. But
you went far, mate. You went pretty far.
But it was the right thing to do. I wouldn't even know how to make that movie now necessarily. You know, that was something I had to do that at that time in my life. But
I was on the set of that movie just thinking, Jesus Christ, this John Hyams guy, he's a sick puppy.
Yeah. Well, it was like, we're going to push this so far that you can't ignore it. And my feeling was always, even when it came to the story and how, to some people, it was indecipherable and how confused you are throughout the movie. And I just felt I wanted to make a movie that a lot of people were going to hate, but that the people who liked it were going to love it.
You are, if nothing else, an extremely bold filmmaker. And I love that about you. I applaud you for that.
I appreciate the sentiment. I think, you know, as a filmmaker who had only had a couple things under my belt, you're sort of fighting for your own survival too. You know, I come from documentaries. I kind of thought I was going to exist in that sort of world. I always imagined that I would be making, I don't know, when I came out of school, I thought I'd be doing like, you know, like Jim Jarmusch movies or like Richard Linklater movies, you know, that's the stuff I didn't think I'd be doing action genre or anything like that.
Yeah.
Even though I secretly love genre, and growing up, my favorite movies were Alien and Jaws and Escape from New York and that kind of stuff. So I obviously love genre. But when it came time for doing Day of Reckoning, I thought, oh man, I mean, I'm doing another sequel to a franchise that many people may not even care at all about.
Yeah.
How do I make this stand out? Like, this could be the last movie I ever make. I'm going balls out, you know?
Yeah.
So I think I made that movie thinking every day I was maybe going to get fired or just it was going to, that would be it. But I often make things even today just thinking, well, this could be it. So you really get nowhere by reinforcing the obvious and just doing more of the same. Even if your story is super simple. I mean, the movie I just did, or the last movie I did before Black Summer that just coming out this weekend, actually, Alone, is like the most stripped down thriller ever. To the point where, like, the story is the most common story ever told, like a man pursuing a woman and trying to do her harm. Yeah. So, but that was kind of the point of it. It's like, I'm going to tell a story we've seen 1,000 times before, but we're going to experience it in a different way. You're going to really feel something with this, or you're going to feel different. And so I just feel like every time out, you have to always take a big swing. In the case of that one, it was like, it was so minimal that it's just going to be, that it has almost no, barely, you know, so little dialogue, only 2 characters. There was originally more and I took them out. It's a pure suspense thriller. It has action in it. It's not an action movie, but it has some moments of action. But again, it's a case of, it was the minimalism. It was like sticking to this really something so basic, something so stripped down, and that makes producers nervous, you know? So there was times when producers got nervous and times in post where they were not sure if this is how people are going to feel about it.
Yeah.
I think some of the inspiration at that time, I was really interested in this filmmaker named Gaspar Noé, who's a very brilliant filmmaker who has done some incredible movies, most memorably Irreversible. And he did another one called Enter the Void. And I remember when we were in Louisiana, prepping this, I had always had Enter the Void just playing on a loop on the, on the TV in my office. And I think when it was originally written, this scene, it wasn't first person point of view. There came a decision to how are we going to, that was a nice practical effect. I remember this one.
Yes.
We built the set two ways there. I think I came up early with the idea that some of this movie plays in the character's memory and some of it plays, you know, in him in real time. And let's start this scene off as a pure horror scene. If you know the story that we are getting at, you know, the whole point of this story is that we're going to create a super soldier that is driven by personal revenge, not by allegiance to or obedience to a government or doctrine, because they're ultimately no one, even if you create them, are obedient, but everyone can believe in revenge. And I thought this was almost our way of playing into the revenge movie trope, which is a death wish. You know, something horrible happens to the main character, usually the main character's family.
Yeah.
And that gives that character license to now rip everybody a new one for the rest of the movie. And we're going to be excited by that. You know, and that's pretty much going to be, that's every revenge tale. Well, let's make a story where a guy witnesses a horrible, brutal murder of his family at the hands of the hero of the old movies.
Yeah.
And we're going to spend the whole movie. This guy's entire intention is just, I'm going to kill a guy.
Can I just say, John, just quickly, I spent the whole day in makeup just for this shot.
Yeah.
you're welcome.
It's a good shot though, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was like, there were so many things at work in this scene, just the sheer horror of it, that it's every person's nightmare. But then to have Jean-Claude come and crouch, or this masked hooded man come crouch down in front of the camera, pull the hood off, and it's the hero of the old movies. And now he's going to basically murder a woman and a child. Now, I don't even know if I would have done this. I wouldn't have done this scene if this was not an implanted memory, you know? Yeah. But because it wasn't really happening, I could say, all right, let's create the horror. But it's also, part of this scene was almost to make all the people who were fans of the original films to say, oh my God, you know? And they're either going to be hate me after this scene or they're going to be along for the ride. They're going to want to see. This is a very intriguing beginning. The hero is doing this. You know, how do we come to terms with that?
How is that practically done, John? Is that just something behind the sofa that's firing a load of stuff up the wall?
Yeah, it's behind that chair. We just blasted on the wall there. You could see it's not even directly behind her, but it's, you know, close enough.
Oh, it definitely works. Well, it is a shocking beginning to a movie, especially, right. Even just putting the gun up to the little girl's head.
Right. We never actually pulled the trigger and she gave that screen. It was, yeah. And then there you go. So that's how we begin.
Mixing the scream from my character in his dream here in the open, first time we meet him in the bed, coming out with the green goo. Bloody hell, what a way to start a film.
Yeah. And that was the story of, scene was really you being born, you know, you were a baby. And that was kind of it was getting into the whole clone thing, which I love that how we really thought about first, your legs don't work, you know,
but it's great because I am a clone and I'm a newborn baby and I'm trying to figure myself out, but then you can hide it behind the fact that he's coming out of a coma because Van Damme that
he's been injured. Him.
You've got to learn to kind of walk again and get your senses back because you've been in a coma for 9 months.
Suffered a traumatic brain injury, 9 month coma, all that stuff. And then it was like all those scenes where you know, when you first show up at like the strip club and then you're walking with your cane and then you put your cane away and,
And there's always a government official somewhere in the background just keeping an eye on me.
Yeah.
My point of contact, but really is pulling the strings.
And I think the big move we did on that with your character was we have a character and an actor who's can do incredible things physically, stunt wise, but it's going to take 50 minutes before we actually reveal that.
Well, that's okay though, John, because it turned up without an ACL.
Exactly. So you needed to rest up a little bit.
Yeah. I was so scared to tell you, so I didn't for a few weeks until I had to. But anyway, it works out fine.
Somehow you managed it. I'll never know how. And you don't want to hear a wild story because I'm starting to feel like maybe I have something to do with this. But,
you're touching wood there, John.
Yeah, basically, I was. Because on this movie alone, which is about a woman being, again, pursued by a man, it's kind of like Duel meets Deliverance type of story. On day one of our shoot, day one of the kind of chase portion of the shoot, she just was running from point A to point B, broke her foot.
The
second run of the day. And it was the very beginning of the shoot. And I immediately thought of you and your knee, and in both cases, you know, and that's so much of film production is you're constantly problem solving and you're adjusting.
Stuff that the audience will never know about.
It's true. They won't ever know about them. But what I did learn is that when those things happen, they either are the thing that's going to sort of bury the movie, or you really can look at them as, and I try to as well, we have to find a way to make the movie better. Doesn't mean it makes it worth it. No injury is worth it, but we have to make the movie better, you know? And somehow I actually think it made Day of Reckoning better. And the reasoning is because I believe if you hadn't had that injury, there would be an inclination to have you doing more acrobatic stuff. Mm. And instead, we said, we're just going to go for heavy impact stuff, which is what you were leaning into anyway.
I didn't have a choice.
You didn't have a choice. Yes. And Larnell was great at designing these things. And I mean, the things that you could do with a busted knee is sort of amazing, but it's like, I can jump and put 2 feet in your chest, which most people can't do on two good knees, but I can't do the spinning around whatever. And I think that's was ultimately better. You did enough amazing shit in the movie, but that knee kind of kept you on the ground and it kept our action. We just had to make it extra brutal. You know, I had written the first script for this movie was a totally different story, and it actually got rejected by Dolph and a number of people. They felt it was too far away from the mythology.
Okay.
And there was a couple of little elements that remained. One, Van Damme being this kind of cult-like figure, and this sporting goods store fight. That was one thing I thought I always wanted to see. People fight with aluminum baseball bats.
Wait, I've got a wooden one.
Well, you have the wooden one breaks, right?
So where can we have a fight sequence? I've got an idea. Sporting goods store, picking up all that stuff.
So the wooden bat breaks, and then you're going to need an aluminum one to be able to handle this guy.
I don't know if anyone ever notices, but there's a hole there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Take before.
It's funny. Like today, if we did that, we would have cleaned that up digitally. And you could have then, but some things just like, it didn't matter. We just left it.
He is an absolute animal, Andre. Great guy. But working with him is like working with a man possessed. Every take, he will go into it 100%. I remember when he came through the door with the axe in the other side, and he would swing the axe at my head to go to the vase. And he swung it so hard that his knuckles smashed into the door frame. And I thought, well, he'll probably take it easy on take number two. No, even harder this time. Whack! Knuckles into the door frame. Crazy guy.
Yeah. No, he's from Belarus. I mean, Andre is a different breed of human.
Now, we were using real bats here, weren't we?
No. No, we remember what happened? So day one, our bats, our prop master, who ended up quitting day one of this fight. It was a 2-day fight. Day one, I remember she had built all these bats that had a wooden dowel in the center.
Yeah.
That was the structure. So they broke every single take. And that was just the first few moves of the fight. I think we broke every single bat.
Yeah, we're done.
And somehow, miraculously, by day two, we got bats that had a plastic core. So
there was a little bit where we were using some real bats.
There's a couple moments with the real bats, but like that.
Don't worry, it won't get you into trouble with it.
Here you go.
Bang. I mean, that's too far, isn't it?
Yeah, probably.
Oh, I love it. Talk about winning a fight. And it's the face he pulls just before.
Yeah, like, oh, shit. It's a home run swing.
Bang. Beautiful, man. That's a great fight scene.
Yeah, but what was cool about that scene and what was really designed by Larnell was like, this is the hero discovering his superpower scene. So throughout the scene, it's you know, bit by bit, first you're on the defensive and then something happens and you realize you learn something about yourself. You get a lick on him basically. And then he throws the bowling ball and you hit it. And it's like, oh.
I've got to tell you, when I punched that bowling ball and it wasn't real, but whatever it was made of still really hurt.
I bet. It was a little harder than it should have been.
A little bit, yeah. Well, I think they glued one back together and they glued it a bit too good or something like that. I remember in the shot thinking, keep it together. That hurt.
Let's do a scene that is basically a fight scene, but it's going to start in cars and then end up hand to hand. So we kind of thought of the car bit as another aspect of the fight because wanted to get these guys in cars, but no one would be chasing anyone really. There was no purpose for a chase. So let's just put these two guys in pieces of machinery and they're just going to ram the hell out of each other, and then there's going to have a glorious wreck, and now we're just getting started. You know, that was
the inspiration then was, we can't really have a car chase, but I like something like that, but there's no point chasing, so let's just make it a fight.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And let it be part of a fight, you know, let's have a cars scene that leads into a hand-to-hand scene so that the car part is really the setup for
a midpoint action sequence.
The fight is actually more impressive than the car bit, but the car bit is just kind of like, you know, is the appetizer, you know, just kind of setting up. We see, and it just kind of tells you about these guys.
The hors d'oeuvres.
That's right.
When you decided to tell everyone that because it was 3D, the depth perception, you could tell. So you had the bright idea to tell Andre to get this close to my face as opposed to this. You've got to be this close.
Well, and I didn't even want to do it in 3D. And then we looked at the monitor in 3D with a normal fight movie punch and we're like, he's missing him by 2 feet. We can see this. This is really a problem. We actually have to get closer now, which is
we're
never
have
ideal.
To tell the ex-heavyweight UFC champion to get this close.
Fortunately, Andre has pretty good body control, you know, because you always worry when it's just an MMA guy, but he's a pretty good stunt guy.
Yeah, you know? He was good.
He learned how to be. He needed to learn how to react. That was the funny thing with Andres. He couldn't, in the first movie I did with him, he could never react. I remember we would do the scene and he'd be getting punched and hit with all these things and he'd just be going like this. And I said,
I show no pain.
Yeah, I said, Andre, you got to like act like someone just punched you in the face. And he's like, I did. You know, I'm like, you know, I was like, Andre, act like it's me getting punched in the face. You know, what would I do if I got punched in the face? My head would snap way back. Now, don't forget how you would handle it. That scene in the sporting goods store was a single camera scene. And it's the best fight. It's the best fight we did. And I realized ever since then, I really have no interest in two cameras. And I don't, for Black Summer, it's single. I just do single camera. I realize that's the way I think as a filmmaker, is a single camera. I don't.
It's not nice to just have one just as a backup? Just in case?
No, but the problem, I mean, it because
you don't want to use it.
Well, sometimes when you have a second one, you're going to spend energy trying to fit that in. And you try and fit them both in there. And now you're compromising both cameras because B cameras, like A camera's just getting in the way of B camera. Hey, can you move back just a little bit? Okay. And now suddenly everyone's moved back. Everyone's accommodating each other. And I'd rather have moving master shots. I mean, my show Black Summer, we do no coverage at all. We pretty much, most of the scenes, I'd say 90% of the scenes are oners. Whether it's dialogue, action. If it's action, it's almost definitely a oner. Everything.
Yeah.
What's that?
You're a big fan of the oner. You use the oner in Regeneration. Obviously, there's that big oner in Day of Reckoning. And that in Black Summer, what I love that sequence where you see the lady get turned into a zombie, she changes into a zombie, then she goes on a zombie rampage, and you follow her in the one shot for the whole thing. It's amazing.
You know, in season two, we've upped that. Because that was like, we did a version, it was a cool scene with her. And in fact, that one is actually not a oner. We follow her for a bit. There's a big part of it that's a oner.
Right.
But there is a couple shots in that, but we decided. And again, we're not doing oners just to be fancy because it's like, you know, because
it's not a gimmick.
It's not a gimmick. Anyone can do it. It's just a choice. But what we find is that when you're not having a cut or an obvious cut, and again, I don't even care. We don't usually achieve them in one. We're stitching them together with multiple shots. Yeah. But the effect of it is that you're watching something in real time without a cut. So you're really watching it, and it
pulls you in, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it slowly pulls you in.
You're witnessing it, you know. Yeah. I think because it's not been, the time has not been compressed in any way, and your vantage point. So it's not, and we also feel like I can do coverage in a single take. We just use our editorial sense when we're on the set. So, okay, if this part of the scene, he walks into the room, now he comes in, and now he looks over there and he sees the other person. So now we go to them. Yeah. And now that person walks into a close-up. So now we have a close-up. And now their hand goes to the phone. So we go to the phone and he picks it up. And now we look at the other guy and we get his reaction. You can do
all that. You're not afraid to make your editing decisions there on the set on the day.
I decided that I'm going to do it. And it's when I first started Black Summer, the reason I did it was because I was so used to editing my own stuff. And I knew that now I'm going to do a long season, not a long season, only 8 episodes, but it's a lot of material. I'm going to have to rely on editors. So I'm going to have very few shots so that it won't be very hard to edit. And then I started leaning to, let's just have all the cuts predetermined. Now that was how I went into it. I've since am working with brilliant editors, and they save our ass every day through a lot of ingenious ways. And I trust these editors even with stuff that even if it has coverage, but that was the reason. The reason why I went into it was just I didn't know I was going to have the time to edit. But in doing it, I also realized, I mean, I always loved long take things, and people always remember those moments. And I think they remember it because it's a real time experience. You know, some people have talked about those in the Universal Soldier movies and saying, oh, it's like a video game. And it's like, yeah, well, that's kind of the interesting part of a video game is that there's no cuts. You know, you're it's a third person, or I even say that our use of camera is like second person. It's like right over the person's shoulder. And but there's something about, now I don't think everything should be done this way, but certainly Black Summer, that is the, because Black Summer is a show that exists in complete real time. There's no time compression. Right. Our story is told in chapters, and every chapter is in real time. We never switch points of view. You're always, you know, the only time a point of view is switched is when the camera leaves one person and goes to another person. But we're never on one side of the door and the other side of the door. You're only on one side of the door, you know? So I feel like that sporting goods store fight was a lesson for me, which is, for some reason, only being stuck with one camera, the fight was better because the shots were better. And we just did one shot into the next. And it has a very single camera feel that, again, I've taken further in other things, but that certainly is the way I see stuff, you know. And there's people like Tony Scott or Michael Bay or Ridley Scott where it's like, you can have eight cameras and it's a very cubist kind of sensibility, which can be great. To me, I like to have the shots linger. I feel that's more my aesthetic.
Well, for me, I like to use two cameras for a fight sequence. The number one reason being, don't have enough time. So we have to move quite quickly. And I just like that second camera at most of the time at a 45 degree angle to the main camera. And I'll try and make it all work for the main. But just in case we don't and we've had to move on and we didn't get enough time, it's an insurance policy. But hopefully.
That's true. Yeah. That's one way. I mean, that's a way to look at it. But I would argue you figure out what time you have. You can do everything in the same amount of time, single camera. You maybe can't do as many moves, but if you do it single camera, you can. I think it's important to make sure you get it for one camera. And if you don't have the time, then do less moves. You know, make your schedule the right schedule.
But I have a lot of action in my films.
You do. Well, and your films, probably the aesthetic is a multiple camera thing. I mean, it's not to say that no one should do it. I'm speaking for myself. Like I say, cutting is important and great stuff. I mean, the Bourne supremacy.
Well, what's your view on the whole shaky cam thing? Because I detest it. And I absolutely detest it. I understand how it's meant to make the audience feel and it, you know, that fly on the wall documentary feel and all the rest of it. But in terms of for action, what you are saying is the perfect way to approach a fight sequence for me is this is the angle I want and we're going to make what's in the frame perfect. And when we've got it, we're going to move on to the next part of the fight. But what's your view on the
other? Well, yes, and that camera's going to move. Now, shaky cam, shaking a camera for the sake of shaking is not something I'm ever interested in doing. Handheld is a great tool, but it really has to do with what lens is on the camera. So if you're handheld with a long lens, that's what we call shaky cam. Because a long lens shaking, it's now you're trying to obscure action, and it's been used, I think, to do stunts and things and choreography that isn't quite landing and making it, you can manipulate it editorially.
Disguise the fact that it's a
miss. Disguise the fact that it's actually, it wasn't a good stunt or it wasn't a good move. But, you know, we did quite a bit of handheld in Day of Reckoning, but it's not shaky cam. It was, the lens was wide enough, you know, so.
Well, it was like, always framed so you could see the action.
That's right.
But sometimes you'll have that close-up camera over the shoulder of another camera, right? And they'll end up using the close one, and you're just not really seeing the techniques. You just see
this. I never shoot action wide and tight. I got away from the long lens because it's like I don't want the. I'll never use the tight version. The tight version is useless to me. It's the worst part of it. Just shoot. Pick your lens, whatever it's going to be. On Black Summer, we live on a 29 most of the time. You know, on Day of Reckoning, we were on the 25 most of the time, 21, 25. And so you're really, even when that's close to the action, you still have geography. You can still see what's happening. Too many edits is an act of impatience, and it's an act of feeling like the audience, you're afraid that the audience doesn't think that the shot is worth watching, that they're going to get bored with the shot. So instead of shooting a fight or shooting a scene where you're just taking bit, 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 why don't you see how long this shot can stay interesting? Maybe it's for a few moves. Maybe it's several moves. Maybe it's the whole thing. Who knows? But the audience loves when they can see what the hell's going on and when they feel like this is not a compression of time. And I think more and more, I mean, I think that quick cutting stuff is becoming less fashionable. I think people are understanding that you can do great stuff and let the camera, let the shot play and do beautiful moves over and over. When you guys do this, you know, choreography, you're able to do several moves, really complicated ones. Now, you can shoot them from multiple angles, or you can shoot them from a moving master that's capturing all these moves, and now you've got it. And it's going to be way cooler and more cinematic, but yes, everything has to land. You get out of the mentality of like, well, it was okay.
It's harder for the performers to do, though. I mean, that's what it comes down to, really. They need to be trained well, or they need to be like me and have done martial arts for so long. And then we can, you know, then you could just put the camera all the way back over there and we're still going to make it look good. But I guess for people that don't know how to do it, that they're disguising it for that reason, aren't they?
Well, yeah. And then if the people don't know how to do it and you need in the movie for them to know how to do it, then you use a stunt guy or a stunt woman who knows how to do it, and you obscure that actor. And I've certainly done that, but the audience still wants to see. They want to see the thing happen, whatever it is, a stunt, a move, you know, cutting so fast is at a certain point you're doing it. You start to think, when you first start out editing, you immediately start cutting. You think more cuts.
Yeah.
The better I am at editing, the less cuts I do, you know, right. Now I'm at the point where there's almost none, where there's none, no visible ones, because I think that's when you realize that the experience is watching something happen and make you feel like it happened, you know, and to make it feel like it happened in a single take. And now we're doing shots on our show where two guys are running and they're fighting, and then they go through the window, and then one of them jumps on the roof of the car, and then the car goes, and then the thing rises up 80 feet in the air and comes back down. Now, that's not one shot. It's a mixture of all, there's visual effects involved and there's multiple shots, but the feeling of watching this continuous event occur that's relentless is fun. You know, it's fun to watch that.
Well, John, thanks, mate. You're one of the best directors I've ever worked with. Amazing experience. It's one of my favorite films that I've been in, Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning. Black Summer's great. Can't wait for season two. And I absolutely can't wait to watch Alone with my wife, because she loves movies like What This Sounds Like.
She likes thrillers? Good.
Yeah. I recommend that everybody go and watch Alone, because this guy is a great director and it's going to be.
Thank you. Well, you're an amazing actor. It was an honor to do it that one time, and hopefully we'll get to do it again.
I hope so. I sometimes wish, I'd love to have another go at Day of Reckoning now that I've 10 years on my acting journey, but we had a good time.
Yeah, well, as we said, I mean, I'm a better director now than I was then, but I would never have made some of the choices I made then. So I look at it that, and it's kind of like I appreciate even some of those things that I, again, think I could improve upon. There's things then that I would never think to do now. So I think that exists in its own, as it should.
Oh, it's an awesome film, mate. Very proud to have been part of it.
Me too, buddy.
Yeah.